For the most wild, yet most homely narrative which I am about to pen, I neither expect nor solicit belief. Mad indeed would I be to expect it in a case where my very senses reject their own evidence. Yet mad am I not, and very surely do I not dream. But tomorrow I die, and today I would unburthen my soul. My immediate purpose is to place before the world, plainly, succinctly, and without comment, a series of mere household events. In their consequences, these events have terrified, have tortured, have destroyed me. Yet I will not attempt to expound them. To me, they have presented little but horror. To many, they will seem less terrible than baroques. Hereafter, perhaps, some intellect may be found which will reduce my phantasm to the commonplace, some intellect more calm, more logical, and far less excitable than my own, which will perceive in the circumstances I detail with awe nothing more than an ordinary succession of very natural causes and effects.
HPPodcraft.com.
Well, sir, you have found the intellects you are looking for. Calm, logical, and definitely not excitable.
And we are so thrilled
to be covering The Black Cat by Edgar Allan Poe.
It's so exciting!
That's us. We're those people. And we are talking about it here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chris Lanicky.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. We're here at HPPodcraft.com and Patreon. Say, who was that we heard reading the opening of this classic horror tale?
Andrew mother Lehman.
Oh my goodness. Why, I'll bet he's got all sorts of things going on at the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society right now!
You bet!
And I'm gonna tell you about one of them in particular. It's a new podcast featuring Andrew and his partner in crime, Sean Branny, called Voluminous. This podcast covers the letters of H.P. Lovecraft in a format somewhat similar to this one. As many of our listeners know, it is estimated that Lovecraft wrote 100,000 letters, or roughly 15 every day of his adult life, so they're not going to be running out of material anytime soon. A couple of the podcasts are already up. I just listened to the second episode on sex, drugs, and marketing, which was great. We'll link out to Voluminous in the show notes. It's illuminating, as well as a lot of fun. Thank you, Andrew, for reading once again.
Now into this week's story, The Black Cat. I have to say, this one got to me. Yeah. It made me feel a deep horror that I am not accustomed to. Warning, if violence towards animals, specifically cats, gets to you, you may want to skip this whole episode. Hmm. Just go ahead and stop it right now. All right, now all the scaredy losers are gone. We can get onto the gruesomeness.
Well, this one really did get to you. You were telling me even last week.
Yeah.
And I think it's more because of the narrator's journey than the animal violence. I would guess that you're somewhat used to animal violence by this point.
Well,
yeah. On this show, it comes up a lot. We've got cats and rats and alligators getting abused pretty routinely. We just covered The Invisible Man, and there was some cat abuse in there, albeit a little less violent.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually been thinking about that. You know, he turns the cat invisible. That would be a really cool spinoff story to find out what happened to that invisible cat, because you don't really ever find out. You know, I imagine he eventually found his own bandages and goggles and tried to find lodgings. I require milk in a sunbeam. Look at that. The laser pointer went right through him. Story writes itself.
It sure does.
But as I say, that is just a cat that was turned invisible. We had our first black cat violence as early as episode 11 on this show with the Cats of Ulthar.
Yeah.
There was a cat murder and subsequent revenge in that story. Granted, yeah. It is really explicit, as you said here.
It is. And just in a way that I wasn't quite expecting.
It's not hinted at violence. It's, here you go, this is exactly what happened.
Mm.
I like the story, although I do feel it's a bit of a mashup of two other Poe stories we've covered in the past.
Uh-huh.
It's sort of a cross between The Telltale Heart and The Cask of Amontillado.
Yep.
And I would even dismiss it as not much more than that, except the narrator's, dare I say, relatable state of mind does set it apart from those other stories that had clearly insane protagonists.
Yes.
Here we get to see a little development of that insanity. So let's get into it.
The story begins with an unreliable narrator. He knows what he's saying sounds crazy, but he swears up and down that his story is exactly what happened.
He wants to get it all down before he's killed the next day. So like The Pit and the Pendulum, we once again find our narrator on the cusp of execution. And once again, like Miss Engerstein and all the other Poe stories we've covered, we get this introductory paragraph before the story is told. The purpose here, to let us know explicitly, the narrator is unreliable. This isn't something we're coming up with. He tells us he's unreliable.
Yeah.
But he's going to lay out the facts as best he can, hoping that more rational minds will have some insight into what actually happened.
Now, he begins with his childhood, and he was a very mild mellow kid, very, very kind. Everyone loved him and he loved everyone. He had a deep affinity for animals. And as he grew into manhood, the company of animals was something that he loved throughout his adolescence. I think for me, this is where I got hooked into the story because I'm an animal lover and I have been since I was a little kid. And animals seemed to like me. And I always felt that I was good at reading animal emotions and temperament. And that was kind of a special trait that I had as a person. But I think a lot of people actually feel that way. Now, everybody wants that cat to come to them when you go visit your friend's house. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times, maybe I'm just remembering the time that the cat runs up to me and they go, oh, wow, she's never like that with anybody else.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, yeah, that's right. I got that special animal thing. But then my mind, of course, excludes all of the times the cat just walks by and pays me no mind.
If I have to go to a party and they're like, you know, we had to put the cat or the dog in the bedroom so that, you know, it doesn't bother the guests, it's pretty soon I'm going to be in there hanging out with the animal instead of the people. So I feel the same way as you. And to the point of having your friend's pets like you, another memory I have is when I was a kid, I had this friend I played basketball with who had one of those dogs that would hump your leg the minute you walked in the door.
Oh, wow.
Just really go after you.
Uh-huh.
And I always thought, man, what is it about me? But then we had this big slumber party with the other kids on the team, and the dog went hump crazy on everybody. except me, and I was kind of hurt, you know? Oh. I thought this was something special about me that the dog liked.
Oh.
But there are two things in there as well that help us understand the narrator's psychology a bit. It says, my tenderness of heart was even so conspicuous as to make me the jest of my companions. So he was picked on for being too nice as a child. And it also says, there is something in the unselfish and self-sacrificing love of a brute, which goes directly to the heart of him who has had frequent occasion to test the paltry friendship and gossamer fidelity of mere man.
Yeah.
And this is somebody who has found people to be unreliable, to be hurtful and unkind.
Yeah.
Who feels it's easier to relate to animals. And that's something you'll hear from animal lovers a lot as well.
Yeah,
it's why I think most people can watch people in films get saw blades to the head and blown up and get their arms ripped off and you just keep eating that popcorn. This is great, you know, yeah. But if a horse or a dog gets hurt, oh man.
No.
The Benji movies from the 70s are far more harrowing to me than any of the contemporaneous slasher films from that era. You know, I remember seeing a dog get kicked in For the Love of Benji and it decimated me for a week.
Oh,
you know?
God.
I couldn't handle it.
Yeah. So this character, I'm connecting with him.
I
feel like I am him, and that connection is important for the effect of the story.
He's starting from a relatable place, but I am guessing that there's some trauma and abuse in the background that's only hinted at in those sentences, which I think is nice. He doesn't really go into it, but I think youth was hard for this guy.
The narrator was married young, and his wife is also an animal lover. The whole time that they lived together, they just had a bunch of animals, birds, goldfish, a fine dog, rabbits, a small monkey, and a cat.
A small monkey is just kind of thrown in there. Was that a common pet in the 1800s?
Maybe it was.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, this cat is all black, which is rare. Usually there's some spot of color on any cat. And it's very large, very beautiful, and super intelligent.
Yeah, he points out that his wife joked that all black cats were witches in disguise.
We've talked about this myth and the historic abuse of black cats plenty of times. They come up again and again in these stories. People still have superstitions about black cats, and they're difficult to adopt out at shelters as a result of that.
This cat is called Pluto, and it is his favorite pet.
Pluto is, of course, the Roman god of the underworld, which is maybe a little foreshadowing. Poe is obviously much better at naming his black cats than Lovecraft ever was.
Him and his cat were boon companions. They did everything together, and this friendship lasted for years. Until, through the instrumentality of the fiend Intemperance, I grew, day by day, more moody, more irritable, more regardless of the feelings of others. I suffered myself to use intemperate language to my wife. At length, I offered her personal violence. This guy is a domestic abuser due to alcohol.
Right.
And it wasn't just his wife. The animals are victims to his violent outburst, but the cat, not so much at first.
Yeah, I think he would hit the cat before he'd hit the monkey, because monkeys can get pretty nasty. I really was kind of hung up on the monkey thing, but it says, my disease grew upon me, for what disease is like alcohol? And I could be wrong, but this seems like a particularly candid look at alcoholism. I say candid because we happen to know that Poe had lots of issues with drinking.
Mm-hmm.
It's very well known at this point. I don't know how well known it was while he was writing. Seems a little self-examining, obviously. Mm-hmm. But he also refers to it as a disease. People had already talked about it as a disease in the mid-1800s. There were physicians who regarded it as such and were writing about it that way.
Mm.
But I don't think that idea was really popularized or accepted until the 1950s, really, when the AMA finally came out and said alcoholism is a disease. For the most part, it's regarded as a moral failing, a lack of willpower. You know, there's you just can't stop yourself because there's something some defect in your character, rather than it being a combination of genetics and environment. I mean, people still are skeptical of the disease model, which is why you have Alcoholics Anonymous. Mm-hmm. People don't want to admit that they have this issue. It's surprising to see Poe describe it that way, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Because it is a chronic condition that can slowly change personality, and that's what's happened here. The narrator's becoming more and more ill-tempered, and he's abusive to everybody except the cat, as you say.
But the cat was getting old and peevish, and it started to bring the narrator's ire.
One night, returning home much intoxicated from one of my haunts about town, I fancied that the cat avoided my presence. I seized him when, in his fright at my violence, he inflicted a slight wound upon my hand with his teeth. The fury of a demon instantly possessed me. I knew myself no longer. My original soul seemed at once to take its flight from my body, and a more than fiendish malevolence, gin-nurtured, thrilled every fiber of my frame. I took from my waistcoat pocket a penknife, opened it, grasped the poor beast by the throat, and deliberately cut one of its eyes from the socket. I blush, I burn, I shudder while I pen the damnable atrocity.
That is some messed up stuff, man.
Yeah.
This went from being an assaulting jerk to a full-blown psychotic.
Well, it's such a deliberate thing to do, you know, rather than a clumsy slap or kick or whatever. He had to get the knife, unfold it, hold the cat by his throat, and do the deed. So, pretty horrific.
In the morning, when he's sober, he's horrified by what he's done. He says, I experienced the sentiment half of horror, half of remorse for a crime of which I had been guilty. But it was, at best, a feeble and equivocal feeling, and the soul remained untouched. It bothers him, but it doesn't quite bother him.
Yeah.
He drinks more to forget about what it is that he has done. This is what got me. This idea that someone can be a kind person, but then something makes them do something horrible. That one mistake can destroy your entire life.
Yeah.
And that horror that you can do one thing and it ruins everything. I sometimes get this where, maybe you do, to where you have that feeling like when you're driving down the road and you're on the highway and you think, if I just slammed on this wheel the other way, I'd go over the bridge and you would die maybe, or maybe you would be infirmed, or maybe you would be fine and you'd survive it. But you would know after that you couldn't trust yourself anymore. Mm. Not with any of your responsibilities. Now that I have kids, this feeling is so much more intensified. Like,
sure.
That it's not just me I'm responsible for. It's all these other people, my children, my wife. And I have nightmares from time to time where I've already done something bad. I don't know if you've had that experience.
Mm-hmm.
Where you don't actually dream of the misdeed, but you dream of having already done the misdeed and that you're trying to deal with it, like emotionally, or figure out how to get around it or not get caught, or having to face up for what you've done. You know, the one that I can think of is cheating on my wife, where I don't actually have the sex part.
Yeah,
I have the aftermath of the sex. You know, it's like I leave the woman's house or apartment or whatever, and I'm like, oh my God, what have I done?
Yeah.
And then having that, oh, I can't change it. It's happened. I've done this thing, and I'm now this person.
Yeah, those are the dreams where you're just so glad when you wake up and realize you haven't done the thing, cheating or stealing or hurting somebody or whatever it is. Yeah, yeah.
Yes. And I just think of it. If you woke up and found out that you gouged out your cat's eye.
Right.
Like, one, that's horrible. If it happened at all, if your cat's eye got gouged out, you would be freaked out by it.
Of course.
Yeah. Like, just in general. Then two, if you were the cause of it.
Yeah.
That is just a deep horror that I don't often feel. And that's why I think this story is so effective, is because it is causing me to feel this particular type of fear. So the cat recovers. It has only one eye now, but it seems to get by all right. Though, of course, it won't have anything to do with the narrator. Mm. They are no longer boon companions. They are hate roommates.
The opposite of boon companion.
I guess. I don't know. And the cat's disdain for him makes the narrator feel more and more guilty, and that makes him more angry. And it's this constant reminder of what he did to his little friend.
Which is another interesting psychological thing, and something that I can understand, unfortunately. I mean, you can grow to hate somebody if they remind you of something bad about yourself through no fault of their own, you know?
Yeah.
And another thing I think I've talked about before, once I was out with a buddy and we were very drunk, and we talked to this English guy who was an exchange student at my college, who had never been to Taste of Chicago. This was 4th of July weekend, and he was stuck on campus as we were. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh my gosh, you haven't been there. You know what? I got a car tomorrow. We'll come pick you up. We'll drive up to Chicago. You got it. We're going to have so much fun. The guy was like, oh, great, so exciting. And then we booze it the rest of the night, go home, pass out. I don't even wake up till midday. And my answering machine is full of messages from this guy. Hey, I'm all ready to go. You know, where are you? Why aren't you responding? And then, you know, I eventually had to call him and go, oh, man, I'm so sorry. I don't know what I was talking about. We can't go up there today. And he was super disappointed. He changed his plans. He cleared his day. He thought he was going to be in Chicago that day because of the stupid promise I made while I was intoxicated.
Right.
After that, I'd see him every once in a while and just I couldn't stand to be around him. He never did anything wrong.
No.
But it reminded me of my own weaknesses and meannesses, so I didn't want anything to do with it. And I think Poe gets into that.
Well, yeah, he did believe a drunk guy's promise, though. And
sure.
Come on.
Shame on him. But then Poe gets into this idea of perverseness, which I think is what really sets this story apart when he says, "And then came, as if to my final and irrevocable overthrow, the spirit of perverseness. Of this spirit, philosophy takes no account, yet I am not more sure that my soul lives than I am that perverseness is one of the primitive impulses of the human heart. Who has not 100 times found himself committing a vile or a silly action for no other reason than because he knows he should not?" Mm. Well, this is an interesting concept. It's the kind of thing where, like, you know, sex becomes hotter if you really shouldn't be doing it.
Right.
It's that idea. You know, people do all sorts of things that are completely against their best interest, could hurt other people, could hurt people they love, but part of the pleasure of doing it, the forbidden pleasure of doing it, is in knowing that it's wrong.
Yeah.
And that is a scary thing to consider about human nature, but I do think he's hitting on something there.
Yeah, the transgression, the fact that you're doing something that you're not supposed to be doing and getting away with it, I think that there is a power in that, that you're somehow bucking the system, and that gives you a charge.
Yeah.
I get it.
And just to even be, I mean, I think it's that underlying bit of self-destructive, that self-destructive streak we all have a little bit, where you know something's not healthy or good for you, but you do it anyway. And that's almost part of the pleasure of it.
But I think that it's possible to, for one, to get into some sort of pervish transgression that's not actually harmful to you.
Well, of course.
It might be harmful to your reputation if it gets out.
Well, that's not what he's talking about.
That is not what he's talking about.
It specifically says it was this unfathomable longing of the soul to vex itself, to offer violence to its own nature, to do wrong for the wrong's sake only. Urged me to continue and finally to consummate the injury I had inflicted upon the unoffending brute. What he does next, he does simply because it is so wrong.
In the morning, he grabs the cat, ties a rope around its neck, and then hangs it from a tree until it's dead. Oh my God, Jesus Christ.
Hung it with the tears streaming from my eyes and with the bitterest remorse. Hung it because I knew that it had loved me and because I felt it had given me no reason of offense. So it's the fact that the cat is so innocent of the injury that was done to it that he hangs it. It's just so wrong.
It is, but there's a lot of conflicting emotions going on in this story, too. It's not like he's
sure.
completely evil in the way that he's doing this purely for delight. He's doing this because he feels guilty and angry, and he thinks maybe this is a way to end it. But as he says, he's crying when he does this.
Right. You know, I use the word pleasure a couple of times. Maybe that's the incorrect word. It's more about motivation. I mean, he both kills the cat because it reminds him of the offense, but also because it's so wrong to do it.
Yeah.
He knows it's wrong to do it, but he upsets him to do it at the same time.
Yeah.
It makes no sense, this kind of behavior, but he is saying that it's also what it is to be human, this behavior.
Yeah.
So it's just an interesting insight. I think that's what sets this apart from some of the other murder mystery kind of, I'm a crazy person thing, right? Because he's really delving into more of a psychological background for some of this behavior.
Yeah. And on the evening of the day that the narrator had killed his cat, there is a fire. The house is on fire. He's awakened by it, and his wife and the servant are able to escape, but the place burns down, and with it, all of their wealth. You think that this guy was miserable before? Oh boy. So after this happened, this causes him to think that there might be some kind of cause and effect with what he did and what befell him.
He's like, I'm not saying hanging the cat caused the fire. I'm just laying it out, and you be the judge. But obviously, the fire is symbolic of him completely falling apart as a decent human being. You know, the whole shell of his former self is burned down as well in that really inhumane act towards the cat.
So when he goes to look at the burned house, he sees inside, above his bed, in the plaster from the smoke and the damage on the wall, there is an image of a cat with a rope around its neck.
Yeah.
Now, it's not just him that sees this. There are other people marveling at this cat image burned into the wall, saying things like strange and singular. And I guess the image is actual cat-sized because he comes up with this reason for it happening that is pretty out there. He thinks that someone saw the dead cat hanging in the tree, didn't like it, so they took it and they threw it in the window of the house before the fire started. I mean,
well,
he's really grasping at straws, right?
It's a crazy explanation. I actually think what he's saying is, it says, upon the alarm of fire, this garden had been immediately filled by the crowd, by someone of whom the animal must have been cut from the tree and thrown through an open window into my chamber. This had probably been done with the view of arousing me from sleep. So it's even crazier than what you described. And I laughed out loud. It means that somebody went, oh man, this guy's house is on fire. We gotta wake him up. And somebody else was like, here, let's, you know, throw these rocks at this window and wake him up. And this guy goes, no, wait, I've got a way better idea. There's a dead cat hanging right here. I mean, this is better than any alarm clock. Let's just cut this down and toss it through the window. That'll save the whole family. Which is so nuts. And then he's like, the cat must have landed in there. Some walls fell on it and smushed it up. And that's the reason this whole image was burned into the wall. I don't know. And also, despite the fact that other people were remarking on this cat apparition, I'm not entirely sure that it's even there. I'm thinking this might be a Rorschach kind of thing where there's some burn marks on the wall and then he just sees that.
Yeah.
Because who knows what they were remarking on? Didn't necessarily mean it was the cat.
Yeah. This bums him out for months. But then one night, he's in a den of infamy. There is a black cat. And it looks just like his old cat, except this cat has a white splotch on its chest. And the cat is really into him. It's purring, it's rubbing up against him, and he likes this feeling. He's feeling that maybe he can be loved again after what he did.
And actually, he says, you know, I'd kind of been thinking about adopting another cat. Maybe it's time that I do this again, which is total alcoholic thinking, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know what? Maybe this time I'll do the same thing, but it'll be different. And the way he describes the cat with the white patch, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but the cat Sith is a fairy creature from Celtic mythology said to resemble a large black cat with a white spot on its chest. So I think this is a reference to that. We may have discussed that myth before when we did King of the Cats. We've done a lot of cat stuff on the show.
Yeah. So he asked the landlord how much for the cat, and the landlord says, that's not my cat. I've never seen it before. So the narrator goes, great. And he takes it home, and his wife is totally happy with it. She loves this cat. And I think about this poor woman. She's married to this jerk. What the hell is her life like?
I saw there was some discussion about divorce on our comments section last month, and it wasn't too easy to get one at this time. So, you know, if you were married to somebody, you had to prove that there was some cruelty going on. You know, and I actually just, my sister's been doing some genealogical research and found some articles. My grandfather was a terrible alcoholic and abusive to everybody in his family, and she found clippings in the paper where they had said my grandma Leveda was trying to get divorced from him, claiming that he had been cruel to her, and obviously that never happened. Wow. So it was something that was difficult to separate from somebody once you were married. So if they turn out to be like this, man, you're kind of just stuck.
Oh God, yeah, especially in the 1800s, being a woman, you were property still then.
Totally, and you know, there's the way that he talks about her. And the top half of the story, too, it's as if she is sort of like one of the pets.
Yeah.
You know, it's a wife I got relatively early, and then I also had a monkey. You know, it's just not, there's no love story here, you know?
No. As time passed, his fondness turns to disgust and annoyance, even though he doesn't really know why exactly. He begins to avoid the cat, mostly because he thinks it reminds him of his deed. But the narrator began to feel violent towards this cat, though he never acted on it because he was afraid to. Strangely, he now drops the fact that this cat has only one eye as well, which endeared it to his wife even more. Now, at this point in the story, he dreads the cat.
Well, the cat is super affectionate. It's always climbing up on his chest and wants to be with him all the time and jumping into his lap. If there's somebody really allergic, the cat knows. It's like you go into the house and you go, okay, I'm not going to pay any attention to the cat. And the cat wants to be with you more than anything. So that's like what's happening here.
Yeah.
He hates it so much, but it always wants to be with him.
Yeah, he says even from his felon's cell, he's ashamed at how powerful his fear was. He recalls how one day he looks at that white patch on the cat and he notices that it's actually in a shape. And that shape is that of hanging gallows.
And now was I indeed wretched beyond the wretchedness of mere humanity. Alas, neither by day nor by night knew I the blessing of rest any more. During the former, the creature left me no moment alone. And in the latter, I started hourly from dreams of unutterable fear to find the hot breath of the thing upon my face and its vast weight, an incarnate nightmare that I had no power to shake off, incumbent eternally upon my heart.
So now he is tortured by this cat. Its very existence is not only a reminder, but a warning of a predicted comeuppance. It says, beneath the pressure of torments such as these, the feeble remnant of the good within me succumbed. Evil thoughts became my sole intimates, the darkest and most evil thoughts. The moodiness of my usual temper increased to hatred of all things and of all mankind, while from the sudden, frequent, and ungovernable outbursts of a fury to which I now blindly abandoned myself, my uncomplaining wife, alas, was the most usual and most patient of sufferers. This cat is tormenting this asshole, and he's taking it out on his wife.
If this was the point in the story, I was like, okay, this guy's got some problems.
Yeah, you're right. He does have problems.
I figured it out.
So one day his wife and he were going into the old cellar of their house where they were living. As him and his wife are going down these stairs, the cat gets under his feet and almost causes him to trip down the stairs. This is the last straw. He goes into a blind rage. He grabs an axe and he's ready to kill the cat, but his wife grabs him by the arm to stop him.
Well, this is almost her hero moment. The axe is descending and whomp, she catches his arm. Bam. Yeah, totally cool. Things are turning around for the better.
But goaded by the interference into a rage more demoniacal, I withdrew my arm from her grasp and buried the axe in her brain. She fell dead upon the spot without a groan. Oh my God, Jesus, yeah. This story is rough.
Yeah, not much of a hero moment. And all the remorse he felt for hurting the cat that he was so descriptive about doesn't really mention it much here, killing the wife. It's very matter of fact that he just went, oh, you're going to stop me from killing the cat? Then you get it. You know, I mean, it's just like, bam.
And he doesn't seem to feel that bad about it, but he does not want to be caught. So his prime goal now is to get rid of the body.
And he goes through all sorts of methods he could use, chopping the body up and burning it, digging a grave in the cellar. And I think this kind of redeems him, actually, because it shows he's a creative problem solver.
Oh, yeah. I never really looked at it that way before.
Yeah, I got on his side again at this point.
He knows how to plaster, and he decides, you know what? I'm going to plaster her into one of these walls.
The design of the basement that they live in lends itself to this. Part of the wall has already been built out for a fake chimney, so there's space in there. Won't look odd to stick a body in. Amontillado style, because there's actually, you know, there's a fake wall and then there's a real wall behind it.
So he takes some bricks and he sets it up right. He does a great job of it. And he makes sure that it all looks perfect. Fortunately, the cat seems to be scared off by what he has done because it's not around anymore.
He's murdered his wife, but the fact that the cat's not around fills him with so much relief. He has like the best sleep of his life that night, even though he's murdered his wife. Just the fact that there's no cat breathing into his face when he wakes up fills him with joy.
So the cops show up and they do some searching for her, but they don't find her, of course, because she's in a wall.
And he doesn't say much about how he covered up his wife's disappearance. I mean, I was kind of wondering, is he demonstrably crazy? Does everybody know that he's nuts? Because they're coming in to examine the whole house. They must suspect him.
Well, I mean, I think in any murder, you suspect the husband. If a wife gets murdered, that's like right away, that's the first suspect.
Sure.
They don't find anything. You know, like he did a good enough job of breaking her up. They don't notice anything off initially. So they go out and look out in the woods, and he pretends to go out in the woods and look for his wife, but he's actually looking for this damn cat because he wants to make sure that it's going to come back eventually, and he wants to find it. And he wants to kill it. He's just obsessed, but he can't find it, and he thinks, well, okay, good riddance. And a day passes, then another, and it seems like he's totally in the clear. But on the fourth day, the police come around again and they want to do some more investigation because obviously they haven't found her. And they don't really seem to suspect him. And he seems to be really in the clear.
They're pretty thorough in checking out the house. It says they left no nook or corner unexplored. This is probably the last little look-see that they're going
to
do.
But then he wants to be sure that they don't suspect him. So he just talks too much. I delight to have allayed your suspicions. I wish you all health and a little more courtesy. By the by, gentlemen, this is a very well-constructed house. I may say an excellently well-constructed house. These walls. Are you going, gentlemen? These walls are solidly put together. They're leaving. Like, they're leaving the house. Yeah. They're on the way out, and he's still talking. He taps on the wall.
Yeah, he taps on the wall where he's got her body hidden. It's a lot like the Telltale Heart, where he's so elated by his ingenious disposal of the body that he can't help bragging about it, and that's what leads to his downfall. But it's also that idea that, you know, maybe he wants to be caught. This story is a lot about guilt. You know, when you're guilty, you want to be punished for it, even if you're trying to hide your guilt.
But may God shield and deliver me from the fangs of the archfiend. No sooner had the reverberation of my blows sunk into silence than I was answered by a voice from within the tomb, by a cry at first muffled and broken like the sobbing of a child, and then quickly swelling into one long, loud, and continuous scream, utterly anomalous and inhuman, a howl, a wailing shriek, half of horror and half of triumph, such as might have arisen only out of hell, conjointly from the throats of the damned in their agony and the demons that exult in the damnation. Of my own thoughts, it is folly to speak. Swooning, I staggered to the opposite wall. For one instant, the party upon the stairs remained motionless through extremity of terror and of awe. In the next, a dozen stout arms were toiling at the wall. It fell bodily. The corpse, already greatly decayed and clotted with gore, stood erect before the eyes of the spectators. Upon its head, with red extended mouth and solitary eye of fire, sat the hideous beast whose craft had seduced me into murder, and whose informing voice had consigned me to the hangman. I had walled the monster up within the tomb.
That's the end of the story.
That's the end of the story. The cat gave him away, if indeed the cat was even in there.
Yeah.
They might have just thought he was acting like, well, he's tapping on that wall a lot. Let's have a look over there. You know? And he just heard the cat in its mind, just the same way that the protagonist of the Telltale Heart heard the beating of the hideous heart of his victim.
Mm-hmm.
We can't be sure.
The Telltale Heart is supposedly a masterpiece of Poe's, and it's good.
Yeah.
This one, for me, again, has a deeper resonance.
I like it a lot. It's certainly more of an interesting psychological profile of an awful person. The Telltale Heart or the Cask of Amontillado, where the reason for their madness, we don't really know a lot about what's going on or what set them off on their path to being crazy.
Yeah.
Here he just drank too much, made a mistake, compounded the mistake, started getting more and more effed up, started doing things just because they were wrong, and then before you know it, he's axing his wife in the head. There but for the grace of God go I. You know what I mean? Could happen to anybody. Could absolutely happen to anybody.
Anybody. So this story was first published in August 1843 in the Saturday Evening Post. There might be some little biographical similarities. Obviously, Poe owned a black cat. He had issues with alcohol.
This title has been used for lots of things that say they're adaptations, but I've never seen anybody do a straight-up adaptation of this story. It'd be kind of a weird one to watch.
Sure would,
I think it works so much better if you can kind of get the interior of what's going on with this guy, whereas I wouldn't want to just see someone abuse their wife, abuse a cat, hang the cat and lose their house. I mean, it would be, from a physical series of events, this wouldn't be too compelling.
No.
I did really enjoy the Boris Karloff, Bela Lugosi movie, The Black Cat.
Yes.
Again, that has virtually nothing to do with this story.
Mm-hmm.
There is a Masters of Horror that Stuart Gordon directed called The Black Cat that actually is interesting because it's when Jeffrey Combs did his Edgar Allan Poe act for the first time, I believe, was in that. Again, it's more biographical of Poe, and then he tries to work in elements of the story.
Right.
I'm thankful for that because then that drove Jeffrey Combs to do his Nevermore stage production.
Yeah, which is awesome.
Poe's stuff, which is great. Yeah. But it's not. There's not much. I'm sure there's some good comic book adaptations of the story. I think that's the best way that you would be able to adapt it.
Yeah, I think so too.
While keeping what's really important about the tale, which is what's going on psychologically with the main character. I'll tell you what's going on psychologically with me right now. I'm full of thanks, and it's primarily for Andrew Lehman for stepping in once again and doing an amazing reading. And finally, I want to thank some very special people. That's our patrons.
I'd like to thank Kirsten M.
I would like to thank Tony E. Crumpton.
I'd like to thank Squiggy the Mutant Wonder Sloth.
That's a weird last name. I want to thank Steve Phillips.
Thank you, Nathan Daly.
I want to thank Jordan Kenequanash.
Thank you, Will Dutcher.
Thank you, James Kristolovich.
I would like to thank Jacob Austin.
And finally, Henry Meeson. Thank you so much. That's all we've got for this week. Next up, we are doing William Wilson, a story by Poe I haven't read before. Don't really know much what that's about. I know it was one that Lovecraft liked, so we'll check into that, see if it's as good as the rest of these. That's all we have for this week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.